The 2016 Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia was memorable and controversial as Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton battled through the spring and summer, with Sanders refusing to endorse Clinton until 2 weeks before the convention. A strike by airport workers threatened travel into Philadelphia. Danielle Daughtry was chief counsel to the convention. You will hear about the personal practices and habits developed over her career that enabled Danielle to manage the stress associated with her job. Danielle candidly shares how she confronts the self-doubt so often felt by lawyers. Danielle recounts her journey from growing up in New York City to Spelman College, Georgetown Law Center, Big Law, in-house at MetLife, and beyond. Danielle eloquently, thoughtfully, and honestly dissects the unique challenges facing an African-American woman in the law and what the profession needs to do differently and better to become representative of our society. Enjoy this episode of Iron Advocate as we continue to explore how lawyers can kill it in the law without it killing us.
You're listening to Iron Advocate, the podcast dedicated to you, the trial attorney. Sage, visionary, warrior, unfiltered, no holds barred, Iron Advocate. Join Bob Levant, Jeff Riebel, and today's top legal minds on a journey to discover how to kill it in the law without it killing you. Because being the best advocate for others begins with being the best advocate for yourself.
Danielle, thank you for being here with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So let me take you back to 2016. We're in 2020. We're headed into the presidential election and the convention. In 2016, the Democratic National Convention was one of the most controversial of all time. You were chief counsel to the convention in that year. What made that convention so tumultuous?
Well, I think the primary reason for most people what will stand out is that we had two candidates. We had two candidates going very late into the election season. And so that hadn't been done in a couple of decades, that you had had two people going in so late, and that there was not a presumptive Democratic candidate late into spring. And for us on the planning end, that meant, so the way you do with the convention is you go into a new state, you go into a new town, and you kind of set up shop. It's a startup, basically. And you're starting from scratch, and you start planning the foundation of the convention and some of the spokes of it. But until you have a candidate, that candidate comes in and they put their stamp on it and what they want. And so then at some point you start working with their campaign to start building out the vision that they want the country to see.
As my memory serves, the hacked emails were dumped by WikiLeaks like 3 days before the opening of the convention. Is my memory right?
Yeah, it was the week before. Yeah, about 3 days.
So take us there. What does that do to people, you know, daily meetings, briefings, business as usual, and how people in your sphere are acting and reacting?
Ask that question, can I throw one more thing into that? I understand too, there was going to be a strike at the airport that would have shut the airport down.
Oh, yeah. You know, I forgot about that. Yes, you are absolutely right. My goodness, I'm starting to break out in hives just from thinking all this.
When we looked at the backdrop of this and preparation for this, I was like, I'm sick to my stomach and I didn't have the job and it's 2020. So can you take us?
So, okay, so backing up a little bit with the controversy between the two campaigns, the DNCC, who I worked with, Democratic National Convention Committee, their position is they don't take a position. So we did not support any of those, either of those two candidates, until it was confirmed who is the Democratic candidate, and then that's who we throw all our support behind. So a lot of that whirlwind that was going on was happening in DC, in the DNC, and surrounding the DNC. Of course, there were people from, you know, both campaigns, I think, who had guesses on who was supporting who, and that might have, I think, when we first started having initial meetings, caused some stress. But I think the way we handled that at the DNCC, we assured them that on our end, in our planning of the convention, we were being neutral. But you still had that. You still had reporters calling. You still had protesters. You still had people sending emails, posting things on social media that were derogatory towards certain leadership members, people, you know, making assumptions. It was all very distracting. And then, as Jeff mentioned, we did have the potential of the strike. We did have several, you know, Philadelphia is a great, strong union town. So we had, you know, union things that had to be dealt with on a constant basis. So it was definitely kind of a powder keg situation there.
I assume stirred the media pot in Philadelphia something fierce.
Every day the media pot was stirred.
And what... And
to be fair, to some extent, that is the nature of the convention. I mean, these things come along only every 4 years, and you know it's a huge event, and so there's always something that happens, and something that either actually happens or something what people believe has happened, or people just make up has happened. So there's always something being stirred. But this was definitely kind of a historic one for the record books in that regard.
What did you do, either people-wise, mentor-wise, to prepare yourself in the big picture and each day for a job like this?
You know, part of my personality is I react to what is going on around me, and I go the opposite end. So when there's controversy swirling around me, my nature is to take a beat, calm down, and stay calm. On the flip side is, a lot of times when there's calm around me, I'm the one who's just like clanging the pots. Come on, you know, let's get moving, let's do stuff. So that was just a natural part of my personality that fit in to really help, I think, keep things level. I mean, the convention necessarily kind of has a large workforce of young people, and sometimes this is just their first convention. This is their first foray into really stepping out into the, you know, the real world. And this was all kind of jarring for them. And I mean, I know often we had, the senior leadership had some of the rank and file coming to our office asking questions, and it was just a matter of balancing, let's get the work done, and also at the same time coaching them through how to handle the pressure, and also coaching them on a mental wellness position. Stay calm. Don't let this get to you. We're just focused on our job, what we have to do, and getting to the end. And you have to tune out all that other stuff that's going on.
What did you do personally to help yourself stay calm? Any kind of practices you had at the time that you utilized?
So one practice that I did then, and I do all the time, is just every morning before I get out of bed and start my day, I visualize my day. I visualize what my goals are, how I want to achieve those goals. And it kind of calms me and gives me a direction for the day. It doesn't, obviously you have to be prepared, and for a job like this, whatever your plan is, you can be rest assured it's going to go astray. But knowing and planning out what the goals are. And sometimes, depending on how stressful the day are, it's what the goals are for the day. Sometimes it's what's the goals for from 8 to 10 o'clock in the morning? What are the goals for the afternoon? It depends on, you know, how much control I feel I need over that day, to how I segment the day.
How long would you spend typically, just for people who are listening to this, how long would you spend doing that? First thing, you wake up and you go straight into visualizing the task list.
It depends. I would say anywhere from 10 to 30 minutes on a daily basis. And I'm just notoriously not a great sleeper. So I wake up early naturally. And so I just take that time and try to use it productively.
So Danielle, this is fascinating to me. What are you guarding against with those habits? So you have a strict morning routine. If hypothetically you didn't do that, or what's happened in the past that led you to that?
You wouldn't tell it from looking at my office desk, because it's a mess. But I tend to be an organized thinker, and I tend to try to be very organized and logical in my approach to tasks. So this just helps me focus. And when I don't do it, for the most part, I mean, things still can go, you know, well. And it doesn't mean if I do it, things will not go well. But it gives me a confidence, an internal confidence of, I know what's happening today. I know what my goal is. I know what path I need to take to get to my, maybe to check off my list for the task. Okay. And that's another thing. I'm a big list person. I will email myself. I used to leave voice messages for myself at MetLife, call myself and just say, don't forget in the morning, this is what you need to do, just to remind myself.
What I hear you saying is that you are managing your own anxiety.
Yeah.
By using this process.
It gave me an inner peace and an inner sense of calm. And again, to some degree, it's a false calm, because things still happen. Things pop up, especially in a job like that. Things have popped up all the time. But it gave me a sense of comfort to move through those tasks and help me get back on track.
It made you feel like you're in charge, not in control, but in charge, is what I hear you say.
In charge of what I could be in charge of, yeah. And right. I think that's a distinction. Because like you made the distinction between in control versus in charge, but I think you also have to realize and let go of trying to control everything and really believing that you can control everything. And that, for me at least, that's part of my personal growth, is I like to control things, and I've had to learn to let things go, let things happen a little bit more naturally.
So that's that is a theme for me, Danielle. I think for many, 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 many lawyers.
Yep, for me.
Yeah.
And so let me ask this. What is the emotion that you feel in and from the law that is most prevalent for you? If I were to ask you one emotion.
Oh, wow. What emotion.
From and around the practice.
Probably, to be blunt, probably the first emotion would be stress.
So for me, it's either fear or vulnerability, I think.
Yeah. Those would be on the list too.
And can you connect then because what you just did was give, particularly I think young lawyers or lawyers that struggle to be productive during their day, some really good tangible skills, but they're like the other side of the coin of what happens, what you're trying to guard against, I think, or control, which is that stress or fear bubbling up. Am I getting this right?
Yeah. You're trying to tamp down because that stress, that fear, that lack of control is what feeds anxiety, self-doubt, And those are all things that can derail you. There's a reason why this profession is, you know, we have a high level of alcoholics in this profession.
We do.
Level of attorneys who suffer from depression. I think the ABA and Ford Foundation did a study saying like 45% of lawyers at some point have been depressed, and 12% of that number have actually had suicidal thoughts.
That study is something Jeff and I talked a lot about in the kind of formation process of Iron Advocate.
Really?
And continue to talk about and look to. If I can grab onto something you said, you talked about self-doubt, which is a part of every day of mine as a lawyer. When you were named to this really enormous post where you know you're going to have international attention, can you talk to the listeners about how that tapped into self-doubt and how when you brought yourself down to Philly to take charge of that position, you managed that?
It didn't tap into self-doubt. Self-doubt just took over. at least in the very beginning, before I went down to Philly, in the couple of weeks between getting the position and moving to Philly, every single day was, what the hell? Like,
I'm going to be what?
Like, you know, how is this going to work? What am I going to do? Like, and it's not a position really you can train for. It's because, you know, you're running on a lean staff. You're chief counsel, but you have your hands in kind of everything. The whole leadership team had their hands in everything. So you just, the theme was self-doubt going into that. And what I used that time was, in a way, to wallow in that self-doubt, to let it wash over me, to completely feel it, to completely internalize it, and then get to a point where, like, okay, now it's over now. Now you gotta move forward. You gotta just push on through it, because now you've taken that time to feel it, to think about it, to process it, to look at it and turn it around and see all the different angles. And now it's just time to, you know, move forward past it, because you have the gig and you got to do it, and it's going to be great. And I'm also really fortunate in this is, everybody knows this, but not everybody practices it, in like who I surround myself with. So my husband is extremely supportive, and I have friends who are extremely supportive. You know, I have my sister sends me, you know, daily prayers every once in a while when she knows I'm going through a stressful period. So it's for me, it was sinking down into the self-doubt for a short period of time to just get it over with and then move on.
Danielle, you said something that was extraordinarily wise about a practice of dealing with your own self-doubt. And this is me paraphrasing it. You moved into it, you listened to it, you let it have space, and you just observed it. Where did you learn that?
Through years of fighting against it and seeing that didn't work, and feeling that heavy weight of on my chest staying with me through the day, the weeks, the months, the years, realizing I had to do something different. I had to figure, I think, one, it's part of my personality. Two, I think it's the profession. But you put forward a front of having it all together, knowing it all, having everything, you know, just the way you want it. And it's just a lie. And so trying to keep up that facade is draining. And at some point I realized I can't keep doing that. And I need to just address the issue, feel it, and work through it. And for me, that is, as I put it, kind of wallowing. For other people, they do it a different way. You know, I'm a big believer in, if you gotta cry, go to room, cry, wipe off your tears, and then come out fighting. And whatever you need to do to adjust yourself, for me, it's just wallowing and feeling it and just letting the self-doubt wash over me and then moving on, and that weight is lifted.
Well, you were doing something, Bob and I have talked about this together. We've had an ongoing conversation for years about the self-doubt. And to me, it's another sort of face of fear, and fear that I felt different times of practicing law and being, thinking I wasn't enough and worried about the catastrophes that could happen. And going to therapy has helped me get to the place that you found, and using mindfulness meditation and looking at authors like Brené Brown, who talks about vulnerability as paradoxically a strength, but you found your way there. And I think it's extraordinary. And you put your finger on it. Lawyers walk around just pretending and really being frauds. And I think we think it's part of the reason there's such alcoholism in the profession. You said 45% of lawyers are depressed. The other 55% are probably either anxious or just complete liars.
Or they didn't answer the survey. So it was lost in the mail.
Holy shit. No way, man.
So Danielle, this is a place where I'd actually like to take you all the way back. It sounds like this has been a process over your legal career. So for me, this has been with me since the beginning, this battle. Can you recall for us the first moment when you thought that going to law school was the right path for you and what you were anticipating or wanting from it?
Yes and no. So I, for your listeners who do not know, I'm an African-American woman. And I grew up, and my parents were both college educated, but they were both the first in their families, really, to be, of their generation was the first to start going to college. Before that, they dropped out in high school or even earlier. And so my parents grew up where they saw Black success, the path to Black success being either a doctor or a lawyer. And so from a very, very early age, those were the two options kind of presented to me. So you're going to be a doctor or a lawyer. And that was kind of almost ingrained in me. And I really, truly believed from a young age, those were my two choices. And so I went to, in New York, this what they call specialized high schools. And then there's also schools that have specialized programs. And so my high school had a specialized program for pre-med. And I tested into the program and I did my first 2 years of high school in the pre-med program. And then seriously, I just was like, oh, this is just too much damn math. And I said, I'm going to switch to the pre-law program. And I did. And that's how I kind of fell into the law. It wasn't really plotted out other than being told, by me at least, but it was more just dictated to me that one of those two professions were the two that I was going to have to do. And I believed it. Sucker!
So what was your idea of what a lawyer did before you got to Georgetown?
Perry Mason. Went to court. You made a good argument and you saved the day and saved the innocent.
So
it was my idea as a fairly young high schooler.
Okay. Day one at Georgetown Law Center.
Mm-hmm.
Was that still your vision?
No, by then I kind of realized, I knew lawyers did other things. I knew it was a much more complicated field. I knew by then I was much more jaded. I knew the innocent, the jails are filled with the innocent and the streets are filled with the guilty. So, you know, Perry Mason can't come in and save everybody. And so I still had hopes and aspirations for making a difference. But I also realized that that path wasn't going to be as clean as I thought it might've been.
And where did that education come from before you got to Georgetown? What fed into that?
The education on
it wasn't as aspirational, or it wasn't as romantic as you thought it might be when you were in high school.
Growing up as a African American in New York City, you can't really escape that reality at some point. I mean, when I was a little kid, my parents shielded me from it. And then as I grew, you know, through high school and college, it became more apparent and you can't escape from it. And I went to college in the South. I attended Spelman College. So my freshman year at Spelman, I remember participating in a march on Forsyth County, which was a county in Georgia that had, suffice it to say, lots of racial tension. So participating in that march and having bottles thrown and slurs hurled at me and my fellow cohorts. I think, work really hard in America to be an African American and not see it.
So, Danielle, when you got to Georgetown and you got an insider view of the legal education and how law students morph into lawyers in the profession, did it give you more or less hope that the profession could ultimately add to righting some of those wrongs and injustices?
It gave me more hope that the profession had the tools to write the profession. To write those injustices. I don't know if it convinced me that they will use those tools for good. And that's just, you know, those tools are often used for capitalistic gains as opposed to helping to change the injustices in the world. And that's not to say, I'm not trying to say there's anything wrong with that, because there's absolutely not. I've taken jobs for capitalistic gains. But I think there's just not as much focus in the law on public service and public interest as this country needs.
What do we do to change that? At the law school level and beyond?
Well, one main thing is, you know, the crashing amount of debt that law school students graduate with. It's almost, you are basically saying to a wide swath of the law school population, don't go into public interest when you saddle them with so much debt, because they can't live with the burden of essentially a mortgage for a really nice house, but no house. And that's what those law school monthly payments are. And so they can't take those low paying jobs, because unfortunately that's what public interest jobs tend to be, to, you know, go into those fields. They have to go to law firms or corporate America to be able to pay off their debt. So it's a combination of managing the cost of law school or forgiving those loans. I was really fortunate. I went into public interest right out of law school, and it was one of the most exhilarating, challenging, and rewarding experiences of my life. I mean, to basically be in a courtroom 3 months after you graduate law school, arguing case, you know, arguing an appellate case is, you know, people go to law firms and they don't get in a courtroom till their sixth year.
That was at the public defender's office in New York.
Office of the appellate defender. Yes. In New York.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, let me ask you a question about that. And the law school debt thing, we're going to come back to that because, you know, Will Meyerhofer, I think we referred to him before as the psychologist who wrote the book Way Worse Than a Dentist, about how unhappy lawyers are, talks about that very thing, about how the debt people think they're going into. And they gave he gave an example, actually, that was very similar to your story of somebody whose family really wanted them to go to law school because of the prestige and the security involved in it, without an actual vision of what they were going to do, and how the reality of the law is just so brutal once you get there. And that leads me to the question I have, that long setup, is what would you tell, if you go back and talk to yourself at Spelman, you're a junior at Spelman, you're thinking about this, what would you tell that young you about the law and about an evolving vision going forward?
I don't know if I would tell myself about the law per se, as opposed to telling myself to live my life. And that's not to say I still would have ended up in the law, but to really do more of a self-evaluation and explore more my options, which I was extremely fortunate that I really did have options. I mean, I went to a good high school, I went to a great college, I did well, I had options, and there's so many people who don't have those options. So I think it still might have ended me up in the same place, but I think I would tell myself to take a look around, walk around the block a few times.
Now, are you referring to walking around the block within the legal industry?
So within the world, to figure out whether or not the legal industry is where you want to go.
It's funny because another thing that Will Meyerhofer talked about when he was on the podcast is the K to JD mentality, which is you start in kindergarten and you don't look up until you've graduated law school. Mm-hmm. And I hear that as part of what you are reflecting on and might share with your younger self. Is that?
Yeah. I went through my formative years with my head down and just pushing through to get to that end goal. And I wish I had stopped, looked up, and looked around a little bit more often.
Let me ask this, what would you tell, you know, all the juniors or, you know, students at Spelman who are thinking about law school right now, as opposed to yourself, but knowing everything you know about the legal profession, you know, freshmen, sophomores, juniors, seniors at Spelman, you know, maybe law school is the right path, but they don't have a specific vision for what that looks like on the other side. What do you tell them to do before they jump in that pool of debt?
I would tell them that it's a lot harder than you might think. I mean, everybody has the whole law school is hard thing, and then you come through and they think once you come through law school, then it's not as hard anymore. But I would tell them it's a lot harder than they think, and it will tax you both mentally and physically. But at the same time, there are a lot of rewards that you can get from this profession. And you just need to find a balance. So I would tell them that regardless of what they decide they want to do, they need to find a way to balance themselves, to balance out their lives so that they don't overwhelm themselves with any one thing. If they were interested in law, I mean, one thing I think that was harmful, not harmful, but unfortunate for me is that I actually didn't know any lawyers growing up. So there was no one I could ask, what does your day look like? What do you do? I mean, just basic, like literally, what do you do? If you're not a trial lawyer, or you're a lawyer going into court, what are the other options? So not only did I not know any lawyers, but hopefully I would tell them to find a wide, you know, swath of lawyers to talk to talk to different types of lawyers to find out what they do, what are the skill sets required for that, what do they enjoy, what are the characteristics that they think are a good lawyer, what are the pitfalls of their profession, of what they do, what are the downsides of what they do, and really just explore that. And that is definitely what I would say for law, but really for any profession, like really delve into what are you getting yourself into.
Let me ask you a question related to that. You made reference to the fact that you're an African-American woman previously, and I've looked at the stats on this. Do you know what the percentage of lawyers are African-American in the United States?
I do not know at this time. I used to, not now.
So I can tell you it's about 5%. And
probably more women than men?
I don't know that part of it. I know that the profession, according to the ABA survey from 2019, there was a profile that came out, I think about 36% of practitioners are women overall. Mm-hmm. But of the total number of practitioners, 5% African-American. And your question about not knowing anyone who is a lawyer coming up, it reminds me of, and not knowing what lawyers do. I didn't know what lawyers did either. I had a vague sense of it. Did you find when you entered the profession, there are not a lot of black lawyers, as I just cited. Did you have trouble finding mentors in the law?
Finding mentors in the law, definitely. Without a doubt, I had difficulty finding mentors. And one, that is because I think people tend to look for mentees who remind them of themselves. And so when it's, I'm not a white male. And so the white male partners or the head of organizations or leaders of organizations who are white male, they didn't connect to me. And then also, I think I'm going to take a little bit of that blame on myself too, that I, as I said before, as a person who was putting forth a facade, also didn't seek mentors, because to me at the time that suggested a certain level of vulnerability that I was not willing to expose.
Yep. I think that's really common. We all have that. We don't want people to see, we feel like imposters on some level. We don't want people to see that.
Yeah.
I mean, the law is already a place of great solitude, often a lonely place. And that makes it that much more lonely and isolating. Did that impact you greatly when you were at a big firm? I know you were at Paul Weiss early in your career. How did that impact you there?
You know, it did not at that point impact me greatly because of two things. One, for both Georgetown and Paul Weiss, I picked places that, although Jeff accurately pointed out the abysmal percentage of African-American attorneys, both Georgetown and Paul Weiss had comparatively a fairly good group of African-American law students and lawyers. And I say comparatively, not to say that it was great, but compared to other law schools or to compare to other law firms in New York at the time, Paul Weiss's numbers were wonderful. They took on the task of diversity and inclusion, I think, well before many other firms did. So I went into Paul Weiss, and there were not at the time many partners who looked like me, but there were certainly other associates who I connected to who looked like me. And so that was really a lifeline for me.
Danielle, so when you describe the arc of your career and confronting all of these emotions you've been so candid in discussing, what are the skills and tools that you have developed as a lawyer, as well as a person, that you value the most today?
My ability to win in the thick of it, to stay calm, and my ability to be honest with myself and others and to accept the I don't know answer. Because I did it used to like to say I don't know, and now I am perfectly fine saying I don't know, but I'm going to figure it out. So the I don't know doesn't have a period after it, but it has a comma after it. And that, I think, is, for me, it was a game changer, accepting that. And also, I would say, listening, my ability to really listen and hear people and what they are trying to accomplish. And that has been something that in terms of like when I worked for MetLife, like really hearing the issues of my business clients, I think that's where I really, that skill really came into being. And then also, again, like I said, I will leave myself voice messages and put post-its on my bathroom mirror so I see it in the morning, type myself emails. And so that just helps me to stay on task and organized.
I mean, there's no question that, right, the law is, it's like a form of combat, which is really what you're describing over time. You know, you're combating your own emotions, you're combating all the issues, and it brings this unique skill set. So where does Danielle Daughtry take that skill set next? What's your vision for yourself?
Oh, Bob, that's a good question. And I don't know. I don't know, but I'm going to figure it out. There's so many things that I've learned on my journey that have interested me and have fulfilled me, that I feel up to and capable of many different challenges, continuing on the path of just solely being a lawyer, working more in a business affairs type role. The issue of inclusion and diversity is something that's near and dear to my heart. And that's really dear to my heart because kind of the things that you guys are doing here with this podcast is because it's easy to bring Black and Brown people into an organization or into a firm, but it's the inclusion part that is difficult. And so with you guys shedding light and talking about these issues, for lawyers in general, having guests on who talk about it from the perspective of women or African Americans, it's that inclusion part that's helping to open up and making a space for people to be open and honest with who they are and what they need to be able to thrive. And so that's something that really interests me. And you know, engages me.
Well, let me ask you a question about that, Danielle, because it interests us, and we, Bob and I, have asked the question, these questions ourselves and other people. And one thing I think, you mentioned diversity. If you explain to, let's say, a well-meaning white guy, because it's mostly white guys in the profession, why diversity matters, how would you say that to them in a way you think they might be able to hear it? Because the profession has so many impediments, and there's so many emotional impediments. The one we talked about, those too. How could you break through that, you think, potentially break through that ignorance or lack of direct understanding?
Depends on how well-meaning the guy is. But I mean, because for some they're well-meaning, but it still comes down to dollar and cents, and you still have to equate it to how is it going to help your bottom line?
Right.
And for some, it's not the bottom line, but it's how is it going to help the culture of your firm, the culture of your organization, and having people truly, because the more you have people truly believing that they can be who they are, the more they're going to give you, the more they're going to work for you. You know, as a African-American born into a middle-class family, I grew up in a predominantly black neighborhood, but went to a school in an upper middle-class white neighborhood. And before there was a name for it, I was proficient in the art of code switching. And I knew how to switch it up depending upon my audience and where I was, who I was talking to, and what the goal was. And that's something that served me well in my career. But at the same time, code switching also puts a damper on diversity, because it means somebody switching to fit in as opposed to just being able to bring themselves wholly as who they are. And so it's trying to walk that line. And then unfortunately, you know, for the most part, code switching means that someone who is of color has to switch to something that's more acceptable and white in their speech patterns or their dress or how you carry yourself. And so you're losing so much when you forcing that person to cross over.
And, you know, Daniel, for me, it's like always been so ironic, because the longer I'm in the profession, the more I realize that we're really just in the problem solving business. Okay, it doesn't really, whether you're a trial lawyer, whether you're doing M&A, you know, whether you're doing you know, real estate transactions, you're a problem solver. And what you just described is, you know, so eloquently saying to the profession, you solve problems better with more heads and experience at the table.
More ideas at the table.
Right. And I guess, you know, you sort of answer the question with a question, which is, how do we get that through? Can you drill down a little further, and, you know, what, so if Danielle Daughtry 10 years from now is sending you a postcard about this and giving you some advice 10 years from now to try to move you forward or help the profession to move forward, what's that going to say?
It's going to say, one of my favorite sayings is from Shakespeare, from Hamlet, to thine own self be true. And so it would be saying that be who you are, be true to yourself, show people who you are. And when you're authentic and you're hardworking, hopefully that will help people see the value in respecting all the different, the full diaspora of what's available out there. And again, as I said earlier, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending how you look at it, you have to also connect it to the bottom line for a lot of places. So when, as you said, when you have a diverse perspective at the table, it helps to contribute to having a product or a campaign or a trial argument that will speak to a wider swath of people, which will, in the end, you know, bring more to the pot. And when you just try to ignore who people are, it doesn't, you're losing something. And so you have to really connect those dots to the bottom line. I remember when I was in high school, I was involved a lot in student government. And we were sitting in the student government office one afternoon, a bunch of us, and I was one of the few African-Americans in the room, and we were talking about what colleges we were going to. And I said, oh, well, I'm going to be going to Spelman College, which, for those who don't know, is a historically Black college in Atlanta, Georgia, and it's all women's college. And Frank, who was a white Italian male, in my classmate of mine, looked at me and said, well, why are you going to a Black college? And I said, well, Frank, if you haven't noticed, I'm Black. And he said, oh, well, you're not really Black. And I was just, wow. I was like, wow, really? Because I've been with you for 4 years and you haven't been hearing me that whole time. And that you know, that's your loss, Frank, but that was, you know, you have to just try to open people's eyes, and you can only do it like one person at a time to what the value is of seeing that, yes, I am an African-American woman.
Yep. And I think that, Danielle, as a white guy, I can tell you that education, whenever it starts for you, it starts and it goes on. And if you're fortunate enough to have people around you who are vulnerable enough to tell you. I remember in my early 20s being with a very close friend of mine named Carl Racine, who is African-American and was a teammate of mine on the Penn basketball team, and who parenthetically is also a lawyer and is now, in fact, the Attorney General of D.C. It was a hot summer day in D.C., and we were in Safeway on Connecticut Avenue. We just finished playing basketball, Connecticut Avenue near UDC. I opened a Gatorade before paying for it, and I started drinking. And Carl turned to me and said, that's white privilege. I'd never do that.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Just the feeling of it was like, whew, F you was my first feeling. I didn't like being called out like that. And then I got past the vulnerability and like, he's exactly right. And it was just like the world turned a little bit for me at that moment.
And you have to keep turning it inch by inch. I have a lot of Caucasian friends, and the most value that I get is, and the reason these are any friends of mine, whether they're Black, white, Latino, whatever, is because we can talk and share honestly. So right. I think the fear is so many people don't want to talk about race. They want to just say, oh no, you know, we're in a colorblind society. And like, no, it isn't. It's not in the past. We're not all the same. And that's beautiful. That's right. Wonderful that we're not all the same. It is amazing right. that we're not all the same. Stop trying to make me like you. I don't want to make you like me. I love the fact that I get a different perspective from you talking to you. I was born and raised Catholic. And I had a good friend at MetLife who's still a very good friend of mine. She's moved out to California now. And she was also born and raised Catholic, and she's white. And we were talking once, and we were joking about something, and I was like, oh, we didn't do that. That's a white Catholic thing, not Black Catholic. But we were learning, and we were able to engage and talk about our differences and form a closer bond because we didn't let the wall of race separate us. And right. instead, we embraced it and embrace the differences that came from us both growing up Catholic, but still just a little bit different.
So, Danielle, the law is such a vehicle for change, right? It has always been at our historic moments, you know, women's rights, you know, the rights of African Americans. It's always been a vehicle for change. I mean, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King relied on it, you know, in immense ways. Yet the numbers are what Jeff cited before. Are the law schools, I mean, they're on the front lines. Do they have to recruit differently, better, to make sure that African Americans don't look and say, well, I'm locked out. You know, the numbers are 5%.
They have to recruit differently. And then once you have the students graduating, they have to go to organizations that nurture them. Because it's not just that there's not African Americans going to law school, but we drop out of the law profession at a higher rate because we're not finding those mentors. We're not finding the opportunities that our white counterparts are doing. And so I know very, very few African Americans that I went to Georgetown with who are still practicing. Other than myself at the moment, I can think of one. I'm going to give the benefit of the doubt that there's more, but at the moment I can only think of one. And Georgetown had a really, like I said, comparatively good size African-American graduating class each year. So it's not just, it's starting younger. It's starting in middle school and high school to show the possibilities to our youth. It's going to college and training our youth to ask questions, to explore, to find the life that they feel works for them. It's going to law schools to recruit and to make an inviting experience for their students. It's to the organizations and law firms who are then nurturing them, giving them the opportunities to grow, giving them the opportunities to build business, teaching them about networking. It's at each stage something needs to be done to keep it moving, to keep the momentum.
It would be a damn shame if you were not a lawyer in terms of mentoring people, the wisdom you have, the emotional intelligence you have, whether it's Black women, people of color, white guys. So I hope you stay in some way, somehow.
Thank you.
One question before you leave. If someone was eulogizing you.
Oh, Lord.
Time on earth is over. Yes. The day has come. You're leaving the earth. What would you want them to say about you as a person and a professional?
I have an answer to the first part, and I don't care about the second. If I'm leaving the earth, I don't care what they say about me on a professional level, because I hope the personal, that I value much more than the professional. So I would hope they just say, she was a good friend. She was honest. She was caring. She took care of those who she loved. And at the end of the day, the profession, I love the profession, but it's me as a person who I care about more.
Thanks, Danielle.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Iron Advocate and that you take what you've learned and integrate it into your own personal practice. As always, we leave you with a minute of mindfulness. Breathe in. Breathe out. And we'll see you next time.